leaders need to be very cognizant of building and continue to maintain this skill of perspective shifting, because it's attached to creative thinking. They've shown it to be true in the brain. When you're shifting perspectives, you're not only are you able to connect with people from different lived experiences, you're also building your creative thinking and your imagination, which is huge in creative thinking.
I'm Dan Smolin, and this is the Dan Smolin Podcast. We help people to navigate the future of work, to work that is profound, protects the planet, empowers people and communities, and is fun to do, meaningful work. The stories that our guests tell and the insights that they provide will inspire you to connect with work and experiences that stoke your passions and make the world a better place. For the future of work is meaningful work. The mission of the Dan Smolin Experience is to help people find success and enjoyment in the work that they do and hope to do. We believe there are four career journey components that get people to blissful work and career experiences. And they are dream, explore, strategize, and act. First, we encourage people of all ages, backgrounds, and levels of education and training to dream about the kind of work that they believe will make them happy and well-purposed. Next, we guide them to explore opportunities to do the work that they dream about. Then we focus them to strategize, to align with the skill and experience needed to do the work and opportunities of their choosing. And last, we prod them to act, to seize on the opportunities to do the work of their dreams. We believe the key to success is intentionality, allowing dreams, explorations, strategies, and actions to happen fluidly. To be truly successful in the future of work, we must be career intentional about dreaming, exploring, strategizing, and acting throughout our lives. You can find useful and actionable resources on dansmolin.com. And when on the site, make sure you sign up for our free newsletter. Just click the newsletter tab at the top of the webpage, click subscribe, and you will be on your way. In a dynamic future of work, agility is key, and our ever-changing dreams can help us to align with future success. Have you noticed that when people collaborate in the workplace, they often pair up with others who are just like them? That old expression, "birds of a feather flock together," fully describes the preference that many of us have to seek out people with whom we share common experiences and training, but also ethnic and cultural backgrounds. Our guest this week, Janine Letford, thinks that the workplace benefits most when we seek out people that are least like us. And to that end, Janine states the case for intercultural creativity. The benefits of intercultural creativity in the workplace are limitless. Of course, when we work with people outside of our cultural comfort zones, our perspectives shift in beautiful ways. We become open to new ways of thinking, and our projects benefit from never-before-considered insight. But perhaps the biggest benefit of intercultural creativity is that people in the workplace enjoy better team experiences, and their hiring managers benefit as they retain their talent in the company longer. In the future of work, we focus greatly on where we work and when, but add intercultural creativity into the strategy array, and the future of work truly impacts how we work. I spoke with Janine Letford in September 2021 over Zoom. Janine Letford, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. Excited to be here.
And excited to have you here as well, my friend. Let's get started. You have developed thought leadership in an area called intercultural creativity. How would you define that, and why is it important for people to embrace?
Well, if you know when an idea has met its time, I think it's that time. Creativity, number one, is still debatable among many fields. A lot of people, you know, they hear the word and we don't even know what it means, but the World Economic Forum said creativity is now the number one skill needed in the workforce. And so the fact that we don't even know what this word really means to education, to the workforce, you know, we have a lot of work to do there. A lot of people think that it's only like artistry. So they're walking around saying they're not creative because they're not, they can't sing like Whitney Houston. They can't dance like Justin Timberlake. And so your subconscious mind is taking that in. And so if you're saying you're not creative, guess what the brain believes? You're not creative. And so part of that is me redefining the word creativity first by itself, right? Before we even get to the longer word. So my definition I'm proposing to the world is creative thinking, creativity is the process of problem finding and problem solving with relevance, value, and novelty. Highly creative people, they're able to be observant and they find problems. They just don't wait for problems to fall into their laps. They're out there asking questions, being curious. And their relevance, they're able to make those connections and they're creating things of value. Even old ideas coming together to make a new idea, those are the people that we need on our teams that bring value to our organization. That is creativity moving forward.
I would imagine this plays into having an agile workforce, because as an agile workforce, like you said, you have to anticipate problems and be able to problem solve them and imagine them in a group setting, right?
Yes, yes, yes. And so the group setting adds to the intercultural part. And that's why, you know, you've heard of cultural competence. What's cultural competence? Another term that people may not know of. Cultural competence is your ability to be observant of people from different lived backgrounds and different cultures. And when I say cultures, I don't just mean ethnic cultures. There's so many different types of cultures. You can have like a soccer mom culture, right? Just a group of people who have different values, beliefs, and systems going on. So someone who's culturally competent is a person who is highly observant of this, and they're able to see complexity within these other cultures and able to adapt their behavior. Not everyone can do this well, right? And so in order to have an organization that's inclusive and has belongingness there, you have to have culturally competent people. And so what my work focuses on is the fact that cultural competence, the cognitive skills needed to build these skills, are in alignment, the same skills needed to build creative thinking. That was my aha moment, because I've taught both, you know, separately, but the fact that you can train them together, and that's where the seven gems of intercultural creativity comes from. It's those skill sets that can strengthen both of them at the same time.
Well, you gave me the perfect segue, my friend. I want you to tell our audience about the gems.
Well, our logo is the diamond, which is a creative cognitive skill, which is metaphorical thinking, right? And I use the diamond because of all the metaphorical lessons that you can teach through the diamond, like how a diamond's made and the elements of a diamond and all the facets and everything. And so that's where the gems come from. And so we have these seven gems that build the intercultural creativity. The first one is called creative growth mindset. It is based off of the work of Carol Dweck, who talked about growth mindset and fixed mindset. That there's some people who think that, you know, you're either born with it, and if you're not, oh, well, you know, sucks to be you. But Carol Dweck and what my work is talking about is creativity is a skill. Cultural competency is a skill. So if you understand that, you can work at it and develop it. You can get better if you work at it. We also talk about creative abuse, that there's people holding on. I know adults who don't give creative ideas or don't even give artistic ideas because of something that happened in the 10th grade. This rate of trauma or abuse or bad experiences into their adulthood, and they're coming into your organization, not giving creative ideas because they're bringing these traumatic experiences. So how do you deal with changing the mindset around creativity and intercultural creativity to begin with? That's the first gem. The next gem, I call it the empathetic way. And you know, empathy is a big word in the business world now. Those of us who were in education, we knew the importance of empathy. Learning is highly emotional. You have to understand that. A lot of my work is in psychology and education, but I tell people that I have a street degree in neuroscience, right? Because I've been in and out of MRIs from college time. And understanding what is going on in the brain is very important. The third gem is observation. cultural observation and understanding, you know, we don't hear about observation a lot, but just cultural observation, understanding that your ability to be creative and your ability to be culturally competent to connect with people is dependent upon your ability to observe what's even going on around you, right? And so a lot of us have, you know, these cell phones in front of our face, and we're just not paying attention. And the word observe comes from the Latin. It means to pay attention. Like, what are you paying attention to, right? To attend to. And so I love to train and to educate people on how do you redevelop your observational skills, right? In all of your senses, but also your intuition, your creative intuition. How do you heighten these so you're able to bring in more data and observe, which leads us to the next gem, cultural curiosity. And cultural curiosity is key. Curiosity, on my podcast, I interviewed Dr. Allison Hoistmeister, and she actually has her doctorate in workplace curiosity, right? How do you get a doctorate in workplace curiosity? She did. And they say, she says, if creativity is the driving force of innovation, curiosity is the driving force of creativity. Mm-hmm. And there's research that's out there that says the curiosity levels of your C-suite, like your CEO and the leadership of the organization, is a huge indicator of the life of the organization. If they're able to move forward to build value and create value, or if they're going to implode and die, you have your Blockbuster, you know, your Toys R Us, you have all of your case studies of what it means to not be curious, to shift and adapt, and be able to have foresight.
Oh my God, two former clients of mine both gone.
Sorry to hear that. But now you can send some folks to me and we can really straighten those curiosity skills. It supports creative thinking, but it also supports cultural competency of being curious and respectfully curious, not entering into microaggressions or things along those lines. But how do you be respectfully curious to really dive into building relationships with people from different lived backgrounds? The next one I have on my podcast, Dr. Michael Platt out of the Wharton School of Business, and he is a neuroscientist, one of the top neuroscientists in the nation. And he says perspective shifting will be a huge leadership training skill because your ability to perspective shift will be key for your ability to connect, your ability to see things that no one else sees. But also, the neuroscience shows that the higher you go in order in status within an organization, the lesser your ability to perspective shift is and creativity is, unless you're intentional about building it, because you don't have to perspective shift, right? Everyone's busy shifting their perspectives to you. And so leaders need to be very cognizant of building and continue to maintain this skill of perspective shifting, because it's attached to creative thinking. They've shown it to be true in the brain when you're shifting perspectives. You're not only are you able to connect with people from different lived experiences, you're also building your creative thinking and your imagination, which is huge in creative thinking. And so perspective shifting is key. The sixth one I'm calling authentic adaptation. And that goes to your comment about being agile, right? People who are great in intercultural creativity, they know how to adapt in different cultural situations. These gems sit upon the previous gems. So to be a good, authentic adapter, you have to know how to perspective shift, be curious, be observant, be empathetic, and have the mindset to know that you can perspective shift in the first place and adapt in the first place. So the last point I'll make about that is the authentic part. We do a lot of reflection work. John Locke says, you know, the source of great ideas comes from sensation and reflection. Mm-hmm. And so, and I'm pretty sure you've seen this in your work, that reflection work of what are your core values? Why are they your core values? Did you decide them, or did the culture and society give them to you? And once you are authentic and you know your authentic position, you're able to adapt. So I can adapt in different cultural situations without violating my core values. I have those skills now. And so how do you build those skills in leadership? And then our final gem, our purple gem, if you see the diagram that I have, is being a bridge. If you understand how bridges work, they are the connectors, right? That brings resources across the different fields. And so Malcolm Gladwell talks about this in his book about being connectors. And you want people on your team who are those connectors, because they are the ones that are looking at the associations and the connections that no one else sees. Franz Johansson, in his book, The Medici Effect, talks about how the beginning of creativity and innovation lies at the intersection of fields, disciplines, and cultures. It's like, who is able to be at the intersection? These are the people with your other gems in place. They're curious, they're observant, they can perspective shift, and they can connect with people with empathy and an open mind.
That's brilliant, as a gem would be, or several gems would be. As I was listening to you, Janine, describe all these things, I remembered in pre-interview your description of teaching young kids. And I believe you taught music. Is that right?
Yes. Elementary ed for 3 years. And then I shifted into the creative arts and music program at the elementary school.
So as I'm listening to you describe these seven gems, I'm also thinking you were probably really frustrated as an adult and probably working in the corporate world, because the beauty of creativity really comes out with young kids. They're fearless. They engage each other. They learn how to solve problems. They can become bridges, if you will. And for the most part, they learned how to perspective shift, because a good teacher will teach them how to do that. So I'm wondering what you were able to get from your educational background that helped you build these gems.
There's a lot there. There's a lot there. And the research is there. So I'm pulling from my educational background, the research, and my ability to work with adults. I tell people, when I was teaching within the classroom, I started a nonprofit as well. So the graduates of my elementary school, I started a group with them called Alumni 360. And I was teaching at the local university for teachers who were getting their master's. So in 1 week, Dan, I saw a four-year-old all the way to a 64-year-old and everyone in between in the same week. I really had to perspective shift. But the one thing is, and you know, because you have a child, children come to the earth with these, a lot of these already in place, ready to be developed. Right. And the brain is the most ready to grow, to learn, to fire those synapses from 0 to 4. Like, those are the critical years. And from 0 to 12 are very important years. We call them the formative years. And so I'll be writing my next book about this, about how parents and teachers and caregivers can not harm the creative development of their kids, but encourage it. I saw them connect, you know, I saw them really be observant. And that's why infants put things in their mouth, because they're like, I have all these faculties to get data from. I'm going to use them all. Mm-hmm. It's the adults that, you know, we barely use our ears, and we definitely don't touch things the way that we used to when we were children. And we certainly don't put things in our mouth unless we're trying to eat it, right? So just watching, I now have a three-year-old, you know, and I love it because this is my research, and I have a case study in my own home who I get to watch. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I get to see him having functional agility, whereas adults have functional fixedness. And there's research out there that say that adults that have functional agility, they're able to problem solve better because they're not locked in the one way this object is used, but they're able to use this object in many different ways. Children do this naturally, especially children from 0 to 5. My job is to bring back the natural tendencies we all had from 0 to 10, bring them back into the workforce, and tell people it's okay to play. It's okay to have functional agility. It's okay to use your imagination. It's not a childish, immature word. It actually is a word that's going to save your organization.
So I bring up the education again, because working with children, and especially as they pivot into their adolescent years, they're now starting to think about what I'm really going to do when I grow up, and how do I apply the learning I'm getting in school and still keep that wonderful imagination nearby and all the other tools needed. Now, what we know in the future of work is that agility is key. I say that in my intro, because our creativity is going to be needed to solve, or at least to mitigate, thousands of problems that might cross our path in any given year. So what's the why of all of this? If somebody hears you and they're like, you know what, Janine, I don't know. Why is it important to the future of work's workforce and to the return on investment on people in the workforce?
Well, you might have heard this before, but the workforce is changing. You know, my parents and my grandparents, the whole system of getting one job for the 40 years and then getting a going to watch retirement, that's the app out the door. And so a lot of people are understanding how to shift and pivot and how to reinvent. In order to reinvent, you have to be able to imagine something better. And so, you know, people are using the words reinvent and reimagine, but it's almost like you can't, you're not reimagining anything. You're just imagining something brand new, because re means again, correct? Right. That's a prefix that means again. Right. And so people are going to see this decade. If people are laughing at what I'm saying now, they will not be laughing at the end of the decade when, I don't care what school you went to, I don't care what your GPA is, I don't care who your family ties are, can you create? Do you have functional agility? What is the level of your imagination? What have you take from nothing to something, right? That, because that's what imagination is. You're taking things from a realm into manifestation, into the physical realm, right? Mm-hmm. Everything that you see in your area, everything in your office that I see now came from someone's imagination first. That's the birthplace. And so who wakes up saying, you know what, I'm going to give myself 20 minutes of imagination training today. No one says that. But in 5 years, just like mindfulness is taking on its hold within the business world, imagination training and creativity training and unobvious association training and metaphorical thinking training is going to take its hold, because this is what creativity sits on. And so the school system is going to have to do a 180, because there's research out. So certain scientists did some work with NASA and decided to give the same creativity test to children. And they saw that, no surprise, kindergartners were at 98% of their creative genius ability. By the time they left school, they were about 10% by 12th grade. By the time they hit 30, about 2% of the adult population were operating at their creative genius ability. And he said, about 2% of the people are the ones giving the ideas. Everyone else is just following them, right?
Right.
And if you look at society, right?
Right.
And so Nilofer Merchant has this concept called the onlyness of you, the uniqueness of you. And so for corporations to really start to celebrate the uniqueness of every employee, that's where your belongingness and your inclusivity comes in. And understand that every employee has cultural lenses. And that's why intercultural creativity is key, because the cultural lenses affect the creative potential of a person, how they see themselves as a creative and how they see the ideas from other people coming in. These filters are adjusting the levels of creativity that's going in and out. And so for people to be mindful of their intercultural lenses and their intercultural abilities, they're going to see the direct connection with their creative potential of themselves and their organization as a whole.
So I spent 20 years as a headhunter, and I can assure you that what you're proposing would be a hard sell to my hiring managers. Why? Because it threatened their legitimacy in their minds. I'm the boss. I pay you to do stuff. And if you do it well, then you get rewarded. I think what you are teeing up for us in a future of work is that a really successful hiring manager is going to be less boss and more facilitator. He or she will get down with their rank and file and let everybody contribute, let everybody ideate, so that everybody has value in the process. Because as you said, we've got a ton of problems to solve.
And that's, you're right on key. But the thing is, what's going to help your hiring manager listen more is we have the neuroscience behind it. Mm-hmm. That's what's different now than 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago. The amount of data coming out of what's going on in the brain and who's available to speak up, is the culture able to let people from different levels speak up? You're going to less see, and there's a great study that just came out from McKinsey. You're going to less see the hierarchy model, the imperialism model, the way that leadership's been since, you know, the 80s and 70s, mm-hmm. and more, just like you said, that facilitation, and also more avenues for people to speak up that aren't even in the room. Like I'm talking about your janitors, your secretaries, mm-hmm. people who have different viewpoints of the organizational structure. And so in my book, I even talk about that, about how the CEO of the hospital, they had to figure out how to get people quicker on the operation table. Mm-hmm. And the best idea that actually worked came from the security guard, who wasn't allowed or invited to the C-suite ideation sessions, but they opened it up because people see things from different vantage points. And the word advantage has the word vantage. If you wanted advantage, you need to increase your vantage points. And how do you do that? You increase the voices coming to the table. So allowing people to share their perspectives, to you've heard the term, bring them their whole selves to work.
Right.
That means bringing their multiple cultural lenses to work. their demographics, their psychographics, because they're all adding in a unique point of view that will give you an insight to the problem that you have.
What happens to talent, professional talent, when they go from a rigid command control structure at work to the seven gems and embracing the seven gems? What happens?
We need to be mindful that people are at different levels of skill set. And before we were, you know, I come from an education background, so I know the education from K to 22. That means concluding higher ed. Before, we were just really on tech skill sets, tech. Do you have the skill sets for a particular job? And ignoring the skill sets of relating to one another. And so for this new future of work to really lay itself on good foundation, the skill sets of communication, right, of empathy, of cultural curiosity, and of cultural competence. So cultural competence, once again, is your ability to see people with complexity and to adapt and to see what people need and see where people are. Not everyone is in that advanced level of cultural competency. There's people, mm-hmm. they call it the denial level, where if you're not like me, I don't want to talk to you. You know, I don't want to do anything mm-hmm. extra to see where you're coming from. If you have people like that in your organization, you're going to have to do some foundational training, because it is a continuum. You can grow out of that, and giving people, understanding where people are. And that really helped me in the past few years. We had a lot of political conversations going on, a lot of racially charged conversations going on. And you can see where people are when they start to communicate their position. And that helped me not to be, you know, offended or anything, because people are at different levels on the continuum of their cultural competency. There's some people who are not raised around anyone who's different from them. That's affecting their cultural competency. There's some people who are exposed to so many different cultures and people and different kinds of lived backgrounds that affects their cultural competency when they're coming into your organization. So how do you make this training and this growth, professional development, a part of your culture to make sure everyone's moving in the right direction of their intercultural creativity?
What kinds of activities do you think enhance intercultural creativity in the workplace? Would allowing somebody to take a sabbatical, would allowing somebody to have a side hustle, or perhaps build their own nonprofit organization, are some of these structures actually doable?
The structure of getting people to work remotely, and you know, yeah. A lot of people thought that it couldn't happen, and look at us today. You know, anything's doable if it needs to be done, and this needs to be done. The first step, I always say, and it goes in the order of the gems, you have to do mindset professional development. Don't expect anything to come out if it hasn't been worked out within, and that's key. And so having reflection work is huge, and not just discussion work, but that is great. You know, the courageous conversations that people are starting to have, which is very, very important. But do people have a time to reflect and to understand where they're coming from? You can't perspective shift if you don't know where you're shifting from. If there's, like I said, because I have my background in elementary ed, people don't understand how critical those foundation years were in their life. And I have a quick story about, I call it my avocado story, where I didn't have my first avocado till I was 22. I had it because someone asked me, hey, do you want an avocado nut? I was like, I don't really know. I don't think so. They're like, have you ever tried it? I'm like, no. Well, here, try it. And I loved it. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wow, it's like nature's butter. It's great. You can do this with it. It's so versatile. And then I called my mom. I was like, why haven't I had avocado growing up? And she very plainly said, because I don't like avocado.
Right.
And I was like, you robbed me from this wonderful experience because you don't like avocado? And she's like, yep, I never brought it into the house. So I use that funny story to challenge people to say the culture you were raised in was controlled by whoever was in charge of that space, correct? Right. And so you may have to do some additional work to fill in some of those gaps, you know, because I didn't have a childhood filled with avocado, making different dishes with avocado, of seeing, you know, as a mask, as a conditioner, you know, there's so many uses of avocado that I missed out on that you may have had, right? And so now you have a culture, a creativity experience of avocado that I don't have, that I now have to do the work on as an adult. And I use avocado as an example, but there's more serious aspects like being exposed to a certain demographic group. There's right. some people who had no exposure in their formative years, and now they have to do the curious, the courageous, curious, and compassionate work of being exposed to. And so I tell people, last week it was Rosh Hashanah, and I know you'll be airing this later on, but I went to my first shul. That is not my faith per se, but just the Hebraic curiosity that I have. And so it was very, not uncomfortable because of the situation, but it was uncomfortable because I did not have a schema set for it. Mm-hmm. I did not have the layout for it. And so I was very much aware, very heightened, you know, and it was a very orthodox. So there was a sheet in the middle and men sat on one side.
You went old school.
Yeah. And I saw the chair and I just sat down. I had my 3-year-old son with me and I looked around. I was like, there's only men on this side. I'm on the wrong side. You know, it's my brain was going. And then I sat down with my son on the other side. And then I'm like, okay, what? But he's a boy. Does he have to be on that side? You know, right. You know, and everything's in Hebrew. I know a few words, but I'm certainly not fluent. But I share that story because it's me being okay with being uncomfortable in order to learn more about a group of people that I, and a group of study that I don't know that much about, that I want to know more of.
Well, I'll add a little perspective because I am Jewish, although I did not grow up in the Orthodox traditions, more conservative or reform, I suppose. Why Yom Kippur is so interesting is that you probably don't know this. You saw people wearing white. Well, white is the traditional color of death. You'd get buried in a burial shroud, that's white. The purpose of Yom Kippur, as explained to me by one of my rabbis, is that you're preparing your life for death. And what does that mean? It's not in the morbid sense. It's in the sense of get your stuff straight, align your principles, recalibrate, learn new skills, learn how to be more compassionate. And these are principles that every year I take to my work. What can I be doing better? How do I reach people better? How do I get them to reach me better? So you actually had a very profound experience last week, and I'm really pleased for you.
Yeah, it was amazing. And I, you know, I have been doing a little bit of studying on my own just because of curiosity, but it really gave my imagination of now I'm in the space as opposed to just reading about it, you know? And I tell people to just put yourselves in different situations of things and get in the space. It's one thing to read about it, which is great. That's a great first step, or to watch documentaries or whatever. But if you can get in the space, get around the people, get around the food and the cultural traditions and connecting with people, you know, and I was, you know, I'm going to be honest. I was the only person there of African descent. And, you know, but they were very welcoming, and it was just wonderful to learn among people who want you to learn more about them.
So I want to ask you about the business case for this, because I would imagine in your line of work, that puts the brakes on your velocity sometimes when you're sitting down with a CEO or a chief operational officer or a chief talent officer, if you will. And they start thinking about, well, how is this going to help? How is all this going to help? And now let's add the layer of COVID when, well, you and I are talking on Zoom. I don't know what's going to happen to the office now. I would imagine some will go back, but I think a lot will want to stay remote. So how does this all work now, especially given the fact that our experience is now hybridized? We might be hiding behind a screen as opposed to being in each other's physical presence, feeling each other's energy, if you will.
Well, the brain is very adaptable, right? Mm-hmm. And you have to be of mind. And we are, that's why we want creativity, right? To be able to think of creative ideas to adjust in areas that we need to adjust. So the first thing I want to bring up is the position of walls, right? There's walls and barriers. And so it's a concept in the brain of someone who has low association walls and someone who has high association walls. Mm-hmm. And someone who has high association walls, like things are very compartmentalized. And so if you give, in my book, I do a example of like panda. If I say the word panda, someone with high association walls might say, okay, well, China, bamboo, like how many words can you associate with the word panda? They may give me a few like hard key associations. Someone with low association walls they can really bring in these other words and concepts from other fields, mm-hmm. right? So like Panda Express, like that's a restaurant. And, you know, it has the logo of a panda, but it has nothing to do really with bears, right? And just, you know, soft or just different descriptive words mm-hmm. or different object words that are connected to the word panda, but some are strong connections, some mm-hmm. are very weak connections. Some are like, hey, how did you make that? And they show you the route. You want more people with lower association walls because there's where your creativity comes from. How do you do that? You allow your employees to have different types of experiences. And here's the big thing. I call it the TFI your life out of the IDEO organization, calling a T person. Have you heard of that? The T person? A T person is someone who is strong with their tech skills. They know whatever, like if you're accounting, you're a strong accountant. But on the horizontal line, they have different experiences in different areas. So they're karaoke, you know, they are world traveler. They do underwater basket weaving and just different random experiences mm-hmm. on that line. That attributes to your low association. So when you're looking for these creative ideas that bring value, right? And organizations need new valuable ideas in order to bring new services, new products, and what have you. Those people can really make those connections and shift perspective more because those walls aren't so high. And so I help CEOs and the C-suite bring in more opportunities to help people lower those walls, if that makes sense.
Well, that must be difficult given the fact that for the past 40 years, they have tried to thread the needle in terms of the people they bring in. I'm bringing Janine in because she's got these skills. She's already got them and she's a subject matter expert in a very specific field of study. But I think what you're saying is that's fine, but you also have to have these other range of experiences and sensory tools to do the problem solving that we need done so that if I were still headhunting, I would have to impress upon my hiring manager, Janine's got all this stuff, but she's also got this and she's got that.
Which shows the ability to learn. The organizations that stay ahead of the learning curve, right? That's when I look for people mm-hmm. to join my team. What have you produced? How have you been not just resilient, but regenerative? You know, like what are you regenerating even from failure, from setback, from mistakes? How have you shifted in perspective these mistakes to keep creating? And so this propensity to learn from every single situation you're in, whether it be good or perceived good or bad or what have you, those are the skills. And so what I'm saying again is the old way is school pedigree. Yeah, a subset mm-hmm. of skills that you're strong at. The new way is, yes, you do need skills. I'm not saying that that's out the door, especially with technology. But the thing is, technology is advancing so quickly. The skills mm-hmm. you learn today are obsolete tomorrow. So it's not the fact that you have all these skills, it's the fact that are you still learning along the way? And a part of that is showing me you're learning in different fields. And so sometimes I even go the fun route and I have companies have an untapped talent show, right? Mm-hmm. Where you have 1 week to learn an instrument and then you present it over Zoom or what have you. And it shows them multiple things. It shows number one, you're still learning. It shows number two, even if you're in a position of power, a C-suite position, you can still get in front of people and show them that the learning process is applicable to everyone and you're not going to be a master. And it really lowers the ego aspect because ego is the killer of creativity and curiosity. And so when you start lowering the ego's influence and the need to look like you know it all and be a learn-it-all and also have fun and show people that you're growing as well, employees attach to leaders who show them they're growing as well.
Well, they partner with them. That's the most important thing. Janine Ledford, thank you so much. This has been so much fun. I hope we can get you back soon to learn more about intercultural creativity. But before we depart, I'm hoping you could point our listeners to your social media and to your podcast.
Yes, it's a great podcast. We have great thought leaders talking about the world of creativity and cultural competency and unconscious bias and all of the good topics that are top of the mind today. And I am active on social. I'm an educator by heart, so I'm always teaching through interesting, unique ways. I even use my son he's Sean the Creative Kid. He has his own social handles as well. But I'm at Jeanine Letford, G-E-N-E-I-N-L-E-T-E-F-O-R-D, Jeanine Letford on all social. And we are at Cafe Strategies, C-A-F-F-E, Strategies. And that's where we have our training programs, our keynotes. We have top of the line keynote speakers. Our books will be on there. And we're having certification programs come out. And of course, classes come out. So corporations can keep training at those rate that they need to train their workforce.
That's brilliant. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Links to Jeanine Letford's book page and social media are included in the show notes for this episode at dansmolin.com. Meantime, if you haven't done so, please subscribe to this podcast wherever you get them, or listen to current and past episodes on our website at dansmolin.com. And please take a moment to positively rate and comment wherever you listen to the podcast, because that helps us to connect with new listeners. I'm Dan Smolin, and this is the Dan Smolin Podcast. Thank you for joining us on an amazing journey to the future of work, doing meaningful work. And do remember this: our best days lie ahead. Let's connect again next week.